It's time to catch the beat from Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming at weft.org. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign, and Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. It is my pleasure to have with me this week Ryan Cordell, Associate Professor in the School of Information Sciences in the English Department. In your work, you've crossed centuries and technologies in studying how texts are produced and shared. The particular place where I became acquainted with your work is at the Skeuomorph Press at the Community Fab Lab on campus and various places where you've even brought a press to print pieces at the Small Press Fest and at the Urbana Free Library at Postmark a couple of weeks ago. So the press at the Fab Lab has an impressive collection of letterpresses and hand type, which you don't see very often these days. And on the wall is a wonderful collection of posters and printed pieces showing what creative use people have made of the lab. So you came to the University of Illinois just 3 years ago, and it came with very particular scholarly interests that include exposure to letterpress. So tell us a little bit about the scholarly work you do and how that led to your establishing Skeuomorph Press.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here chatting with you today. So my work is primarily focused on the 19th century. That's what I was trained in. And I study the history of newspapers, essentially. So I have a project that I've been working on for many years called Viral Text, which is using digital collections of scanned and digitized 19th century newspapers. And we're using computational methods, like big data methods, basically to trace the way that stories were shared through reprinting. So in the 19th century, newspapers all subscribed to each other. And when editors received them, they would look for things their readers would like, and they would just cut them out, hand them to the people who set their type, and they would just reprint them, sometimes with changes, additions, subtractions. And that wasn't sort of skirting the law. That's the way the law was written, because that was how they wanted information to spread, basically, around the country, was through the post and through the news. And so we're tracing that. We've been developing these methods for tracing that. But because we work kind of abstracted with these, you know, digitized collections of newspapers, it became increasingly important to me that my students would actually have a very hands-on understanding of the original materials that got remediated, digitized, and that we were now studying with these computational methods. And so in my teaching, I started initially bringing students to letterpress shops so they could sort of see how printed texts were made. And then I was dissatisfied with that kind of tourist experience. I wanted them to really get their hands on the material. And I started collecting, you know, some type and some small portable presses. That the first version of what is now Skeuomorph was a media cart that had a small portable press on the top of it and some type in the bottom. And I pushed it to my class down the hall. And that conviction that was a valuable experience for students has just grown over the years. And so when I came to the University of Illinois, I really wanted to have a space where we could let that kind of learning flourish. And we were able to get this room here in the CU Community Fab Lab, which is a really fantastic space, as we're doing this historical making right next to this, like, contemporary kinds of making that we have, you know. So there's the 3D printers and the laser cutters. And then, you know, on the other side of the wall, we have a 170-year-old press where we're making posters and broadsides and things like that. So,
and you actually get those to work together.
Yeah. One of the things that we've really enjoyed is that we've done some collaborations with the Rare Book and Manuscripts Library here on campus and with other professors and faculty, where we take a historical woodcut that's been scanned, and then we will create a high quality tracing of that scan, essentially, and then we carve a version of that using the lasers next door that we can then print with here in the press. So we've done that for, there were some images from a Renaissance bestiary, so images of things like, I mean, some actual animals like deer and dogs, but also fantastical creatures like manticores and unicorns. And we created these cuts, and we made holiday cards with the Rare Book and Manuscript Library a few years ago using these cuts that we had kind of reproduced from a Renaissance book. And then just this semester, we had a faculty member in the English department who's a medievalist who brought his students in here. And he had helped us find what had originally been a wood carving to produce a tarot deck, a late medieval tarot deck. And we carved it in linoleum on the lasers. And then the students were able to print their own tarot decks when they came in. That was really popular. We've been printing that tarot deck a lot, even out after that class left. Everyone wants to print the tarot deck.
Well, and I've seen it, and it's gorgeous. You really catch the atmosphere. And you have a wonderful collection of wood type, which is the big display type that's sort of the easy way to recognize old posters. Tell us about how you actually physically gathered all the equipment and moved it onto the second floor of the Fab Lab, these 1,000-pound presses. I was really impressed when I visited. I said, what did they do to get these things on the second floor? So how did you pull the whole book lab together?
I love this story because it allows us to praise some folks that don't get enough attention at the university. So I will start by talking about Tad Schroeder. Tad Schroeder is the director of facilities for the iSchool. And when I first was starting here, I was, even before I started, actually, when I was interviewing at U of I was walking around the hallways of the iSchool, and there was a hand press sitting in the hallway as a kind of museum piece. It had a plaque. And I asked Tad, who was leading the tour, do you know if that works? And he leaned in and said, I know it does because I used it a few years ago just to see if it would work. And so when I started here, I got permission from the iSchool to bring that press over to the space. And Tad put us in touch with the iron workers on campus who basically rigged that press onto a crane and it floated across campus.
I wish I had seen that.
It was pretty remarkable. Yeah, it was a great day. It came all the way across campus, you know, hanging from the crane, and then we brought it right in the back doors of the Fab Lab, and they helped us get it in place. The other equipment, I should say, with that press, we also found a whole cabinet full of type in a closet in the basement of the iSchool that had once been associated with that press and had just been stored. I'm really glad that they didn't get rid of it, that they put it in a closet, because we were able to bring that over as well. And then other things we've kind of collected over the years that I've been here. There was a listing of a printer up in Wisconsin who was basically selling his whole shop. He was not able to print anymore. And Tad and me and Caden Henningsen, who's a PhD student in the English department here, we got into a moving van and we drove to Wisconsin. We loaded everything up and we drove it back. And then again, the iron workers helped us get it into the Fab Lab.
I bet they loved that job.
I really love the facilities folks here at the university have really been incredible. And one thing is that so many of them have, you know, oh, my uncle used to work in printing, or my grandfather was a printer, and they get really excited with the equipment that we have here. And
well,
that's fantastic for me.
It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. You know, when I started at the University Press as a book designer, they were still setting letterpress at the university printing office, and they were printing it. So actually, I had the letterpress printer, was it Corky? I think that was his name, typeset the last printed book cover on their letterpress equipment. So there is a very strong history on campus not that long ago of really beautiful hand press work.
Yeah, one of my favorite aspects of being here is sort of beginning learning these histories kind of piecemeal. I run into people who were at, you know, a particular office, or who were part of the university printing office, or who were part of Soybean Press, which is a sort of earlier version of what we're trying to build at Skeuomorph, and I sort of piece together these histories from people who I run into or who hear about what we're doing.
You also have a sort of an interim era of typesetting. I was very interested to see the large collection of typewriters and IBM Selectrics, which are a particularly beautiful machine, which I have typed on, and word processors, and even a mimeograph machine, for those of us who remember those. How do you use those at Skeuomorph?
the letterpress, those machines are the biggest and the most obvious. And so people immediately see those. But what we're trying to do here really is preserve history of media that has been used to produce books and related texts, you know, through history. And that includes some of these more recent technologies. And so for things like we have the, as you pointed out, the mimeograph, which when we first inherited, it wasn't working, but we've been able to get it running again. And that in some ways pairs with, we have a more recent machine that uses a kind of a similar technology, a risograph. Risograph looks like a photocopier, but it uses stencils, kind of like a mimeograph does. And you can put different colored ink drums in it. And it's used now for making things like zines and independent comics, because you can do a multicolor process and you get that kind of classic comic book effect. And so for thinking about mimeographs and the risograph helps students think about, frankly, kind of early 20th century reproduction technologies and how those intersect with independent media. And, you know, again, zines are really popular. Students really love making zines. And so we often use those machines to do zine making workshops and things like that. And those are fun. And then we have, as you pointed out, the typewriter collection, which that was sort of the project of, we had a PhD student who was working here, Isabella Viega, and their specialty is essentially a kind of literary history of the typewriter, how the typewriter transformed literary production. And so they really, again, much like I wanted to do with, you know, typesetting for the 19th century, they really wanted students to be able to get their hands on the technology that they were teaching about, because in some ways typewriters feel familiar to students. You know, the keyboard looks like the computers that they work with, but they're really distinct, right? They have mechanical features that are just not the same with computers, and they require a different way of sort of thinking about your text, planning your text. And students really love them also. We've started to pull them out kind of all the time, because students really want to type and hear, they get the tactile feedback from the machines. There's a certain kind of romanticism around typewriters that we both, you know, embrace, but also try to, you know, help students think through a little bit more historically as well. But they're really popular. We've got, I think, about 12 typewriters now that we bring out when we're doing typewriter workshops. And I think they're probably one of the most popular things we have in the shop.
One of the classes that you teach is called Book Lab, Print to Programming, and you cross the gamut with your students. Talk a little bit about how you relate the older technologies on up to present and future.
So Book Lab is a class that I offer here in the School of Information Sciences, and the students come from all over, but a lot of them are training to be librarians. And then we also have some PhD students, and I get folks from other departments as well, but the bulk of the class are folks training to be librarians. And for me, there's sort of two reasons that I want them to interact with these technologies. I mean, one, for some of them, they're training to go work in archives or special collections. And part of it is, again, learning in a really firsthand way about how the materials that they might need to describe or catalog or show to students or show to the public or put in exhibits, how they were actually created, how the clues that we can look at in the artifacts that were produced through machines like this, and what they can teach us about the actual processes that had to have happened for those artifacts to exist. But then the other reason why I think it's really important is that we can be very presentist with technology. And I joke sometimes that the main goal of my classes is just to help students realize that technology was not invented 10 years ago. But when we say technology, we tend to only mean really, really recent technology. But all of these technologies that we use on a day-to-day basis, our computers, the interfaces that we interact with through our computers, are inheriting all kinds of assumptions and conventions from this earlier media, from the way that our keyboard is laid out to the way that we expect a beautiful page to look when we're reading or something like that. And so the other reason that I really want students to get their hands on it is I think it deepens their sense of time and really helps them to contextualize the technologies that they're wrestling with in both historical and other cultural contexts, right? And so again, there's all these debates that we have about contemporary technology, where, you know, about intellectual property. You know, this is a big one right now with AI technologies and large language models. And in some ways, looking at these historical periods where people had really different ideas about intellectual property, I think is useful for kind of stepping back from the immediate present and making more thoughtful choices and being just more thoughtful in general about our contemporary technology.
You said on your website about skeuomorph, letterpress requires both expression and precision. It's something between art and engineering, which fits perfectly in an interdisciplinary space like the iSchool. That's something that I have loved about the iSchool ever since I came to this campus, is it leaps forward into new technologies, but also teaches the past. And we have one of the most extraordinary rare book rooms, you know, in the country and collections. And I love how the iSchool incorporates all of these. You teach actual book history, don't you?
I do. The book lab class, we do a lot of book history there in an applied way. But yes, I'm trained and teach book history classes at lots of levels, for grad students, for undergrads.
And when you were at Northeastern, you co-founded the Northeastern University Lab for Digital Humanities and Computational Social Science. That's a large term, and it's still going strong. What was the idea, the kinds of projects and study that that lab would encompass?
In some ways, this goes back to that first project I was telling you about, where we're using computational methods to trace reprinting in historical newspapers. There are lots of histories of this field that we now call digital humanities, but really about 15 years or so ago, there were a lot of folks that were beginning to think about how the increasing digitization of historical and cultural materials might allow us to study and analyze those materials in new ways. And then there was a kind of similar thing that was happening in the social sciences, where the birth of things like social media and these large data sets of culture would allow people to study, say, you know, what people are thinking about politics in a different way than they would have done in the past. And so the new lab for Text Maps and Networks was an attempt to bring faculty and grad students and people who are working in these sort of emergent fields together to think about shared methods and collaborations and things along that line. We have a really, really strong community of digital humanities folks here at the University of Illinois. In the iSchool, we have Intro to Digital Humanities classes. I'm teaching that class currently in the fall semester.
Can you define what is digital humanities?
This is the sort of perpetual thing in the digital humanities. People are always trying to define it and redefine it. I prefer the simplest definition that we can go with. It's people who work in traditional humanities subjects, you know, literary studies, art history, history, religious studies, who are using some kind of computational method to study those materials. So in my case, we're using methods that you would call text mining. Some people are doing digital mapping. Some people are creating digital editions. It's almost like editing, but creating it in digital spaces. But it's a pretty baggy term. It encompasses people doing a lot of really different kinds of research. And initially, I think they gave it a name because there were not a lot of people in these fields doing this kind of research. And it was a way of gathering folks who were doing this together. I think these days it's a bigger community. And I don't know if that term will continue to be the term people use or if it will fade away as it becomes more normalized, but that's my definition.
And I do have to ask you about that word skeuomorph. It is hard to say and even harder to spell. So I think that's a term that you brought here with you. Tell us why and what.
Yes. Well, I wish I could take credit for naming the press, but it was actually that student I mentioned earlier, Isabella Viega. Isabella had actually been an undergraduate student of mine at Northeastern, and then they came here to do some graduate research. And when we were trying to figure out what to call this new space that we were putting together, they looked at me and said, "Professor Cordell, your favorite word is skeuomorph. Why don't you just call it skeuomorph press?" And they knew that because I use it constantly in my classes. And a skeuomorph is a term that it comes from design originally. And in the design world, it would describe a design feature that once had a functional purpose and is retained for cultural or for decorative reasons later on. So the example that I always give to students is if you think of the rivets on blue jeans, you know, originally those rivets were chunk, you know, they held the blue jeans together when they were these very rugged clothes of the West. And now most of the rivets are just glued on, right? But when I ask students, well, why do we keep them? They say, well, because blue jeans have rivets. It's part of the aesthetic of a blue jean. They should have rivets. And that's originally what a skeuomorph means. More recently, skeuomorph has been adopted by people both in the tech industry and people who study media to talk about essentially elements of older media that get adopted or adapted into new media. So this is going to be a radio show, but if someone went to the skeuomorph website and saw our logo, they would see that our logo looks like the save icon, and the save icon looks like a floppy disk, right? Now, you're not actually saving to floppy disk anymore, but that's our kind of representation of saving now. It's this element from an older medium that we use in contemporary media. And there's a lot of examples like this in the computer world. The fact that we have desktops and files and folders, these are all inherited from the office, and now we use them this way. But there's a lot of examples of these in the history of the book and in other media too. So I talked about this. I talk about this a lot. But the first fonts that were designed for printing presses were designed to look like the hand of medieval scribes, right? But even beyond that, when medieval scribes were handwriting books, they did what was called pricking and ruling. And that was essentially a method for creating straight, even lines across the page so that when they were writing by hand, they could keep everything even. And if you look at early printed books, they have the pricking and the ruling in them, even though that's not needed for the printing press, right? The printing press will keep the lines even because of the type. But it was part of the kind of expectation for what a book looked like. A book should have these rules, and it took a little while before that sort of fell away, right? And there are all of these ways in which, when we talk about new media, there are these ghosts of older media that are there and that are present, and initially are kind of, they teach us how to use the new media, but sometimes we hang on to them just because they're part of the genre, or they're part of the way that we expect, a certain medium to act. And I'm fascinated by these. For me, the skeuomorphs are a way of identifying what people find important about, particular media. It helps you identify what people had to be taught in order to transition from an older medium to a new medium. And so in my classes, we spend a lot of time like thinking about these moments of transition, and skeuomorphs are everywhere in those moments. And so for me, in this space, we're doing letterpress, but we're doing letterpress with cuts that we made on the laser next door, and we've got vintage computers that we incorporate. So there's kind of a mixing of historical periods in a way that really, I think skeuomorph is a great name. It also gives me an excuse to give a little mini lesson about media history every time someone walks in, because they say, well, what is a skeuomorph anyway? And then I can launch into my favorite description.
One of the things that I love about Skeuomorph is that it is in the community fab lab on campus, which is open to more than just university people. It's intended to bring in school students from the local community and anyone who wants to mess around with some very impressive and interesting machines.
Yes, I mean, coming out of this hands-on teaching I've been doing for so long, I think that it's a mode of engagement and learning that's really important. I mean, I'm very much a book person. I do a lot of my research, reading other scholars' work and things. But ultimately, I think there's something that you learn from having your hands on the technology that you don't get otherwise. So I founded a very small press at Northeastern University before I came here because of that belief. And when I came here, I was really thrilled to be able to expand, as you said, into this community space where we've been able to welcome a much broader group of people into the press for that kind of hands-on learning.
It mixes young and old and techies and traditionalists, and it's really very interesting to come spend an hour in the Fab Lab. What kinds of projects do your students do? What are their assignments when they come to the printing press?
So it depends a little on what class they're coming for. So there's a lot of great assignments. So there's one class that it's not my class, but they send a lot of sections here. It's called Writing Across Media. It's a class that is really trying to kind of do a media history for students and give them a version of the histories that I'm really fascinated in. And we have a lot of sections of that class that come in. And often they have a small assignment where they just have to conceive of something using some kind of analog medium. It doesn't have to be the printing press. And they'll come in and design things like posters or, postcards or little pamphlets and things like that for that class. I'm teaching an undergrad qu class in the spring semester, which is called Building a Better Book, and it's book history meets book arts. We sort of start by a quick survey of book history, and then we move into looking at artist books and experimental books and really trying to get students to think hard about, what they would call a book and where they would draw a line, where they would decide, no, that's not a book, that's something else. And so we look at a lot of really strange books. And the central assignment of the class is that students have to design a book over the course of the semester. What they do is wildly various. Some of them make zine kinds of projects, some of them work with the letterpress, some of them make digital books of various kinds. But those students spend a lot of time in here, learning the different equipment and experimenting with it and figuring out how to put together these books. And some of them are fascinating. I've had students make books that were entirely baked. They were edible books. I've had students make, 3D books that are kind of somewhere between a book and a sculpture. I've had students that made, very traditional, beautiful, letterpress printed chapbooks and things like this. And then I've had some of my favorites are students that blend the digital and the analog. So I've had students that make an interactive digital text, but there's an analog printed component that you have to have in order to progress through the digital text because there are words that you have to know from the printed object in order to progress in the digital interactive text. And so you have to actually keep both the printed book in front of you while you're on the screen and sort of move back and forth between them. So I love those projects. They're fascinating. And then we have students that come in and make all kinds of things. A lot of posters. We have clubs that come in and make posters for their clubs. A lot of what we get also is literary. We have students coming in and making essentially broadsides of poems that they find, or that are very important to them, or song lyrics, things like that. It's really a wide variety. We try to kind of decorate the walls, as you said, with all the art that students have made coming in, students and community members.
We're running out of time, so let me just ask you, is there anything else about Skewmore for the work that you're doing at the University of Illinois that you'd like us to know about?
I think I would just encourage people to come check us out. We are open to the community in the evenings, at least a few nights a week every semester. We list our community hours on our website, which is skewamorph.ischool.illinois.edu. And if you have even an idea, you don't have to have a fully baked project. You don't have to have any experience yet with the equipment. You just have to have some dedication to learning. And we would really love to see more community members in the space working, or artists who maybe want to get back into printmaking or letterpress that are in the community. So that's the main thing I'd want your listeners to know. We're here and we would love to see you.
And you have made it wonderfully accessible. There are people in the lab who will guide you through every step. So I think we owe you a great thanks from this community.
That's kind of you to say. I've been really thrilled at how welcoming the community has been for this work and how supportive. So it's been a great way to get to know the community since I'm still
Yeah.
fairly new here.
You're knowing it from the inside out.
Exactly.
That wraps up our time for this week's Catch the Beat. Thank you, Ryan Cordell of the School of Information Sciences and the English Department at the University of Illinois, for sharing a bit of the history and culture of the Skewamorph Press. I encourage our listeners to visit the CU Fab Lab on campus at 1301 South Goodwin Avenue, just north of Pennsylvania. All past episodes of Catch the Beat are archived at weft.org under our public affairs listings. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod, see you next time.